Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to begin, as I often do now, by reminding you that we have a volunteer, Charlie Fabian, able and willing to receive whatever suggestions you have for segments of this program, topics to be covered, and so on. You can reach him at charlie.info438@gmail.com. Today's program is enjoyable, especially for me, partly because we're going to be interviewing the speechwriter for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, Richard R.J. Eskow, in our second half, but also because of the personal connections I have with the first of our economic updates. And that one is about an election victory for Parliament in Great Britain. George Galloway won the election in the Rochdale district. I've been on George Galloway's television program many times. He is a remarkable political activist in Great Britain. He's run and served in Parliament before. But here's why his victory in the Rochdale election, and he will be going to Parliament representing that district, is interesting for several reasons. First, George Galloway is a socialist, has been for a long time, is a critic of British capitalism and the governments that it has, both in the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, especially under leaders like Starmer now. But perhaps most important is to look at his vote. George Galloway, running on what he calls the Workers' Party, which is active across England, got more votes than the Conservative and Labour Party combined vote. Let me say that again. It's as if a third party candidate won here in the United States and got more votes than the Conservatives and Labour, or in this case, the Republicans and Democrats combined. Not only more than double the combined vote. The Conservative Party, now the governing party in Britain, the Labour Party, soon to become the likely next government, were pushed aside by the people of Rochdale, given a tiny percentage of the votes, and they went for George Galloway. By the way, the person came in second was also an independent candidate, not part of the apparatus of the two parties. And in the evening, after the vote was counted and George Galloway was named the winner, he looked into the cameras as the TV cameras honed in on him as the winner and said, "This is for Gaza." He took a strong position on a ceasefire in Gaza, an immediate ceasefire, a strong position, and that won him many more votes. And that's a message for British politics, for American politics, and for many more across the world. A remarkable election outcome. Because we're talking about England, I wanted to say that the Conservative government, despite being very right-wing, very out of touch, and very much despised now by the British people, who are set, according to polls, to vote them out of office, nonetheless, even the Conservative government can say things that we can't say about either the Republicans or the Democrats here in the United States. On April 1st, in a very short time, April 1st, 2024, the minimum wage for workers in Britain age 21 or older will be, in British pounds, converted at the current exchange rate to dollars. The minimum wage for people 21 and over will be $14.53 in American money. You know what the United States rate minimum wage is right now, the federal minimum wage? $7.25. That puts the British rate on April 1st at more than twice the minimum wage in the United States. And the minimum wage of $7.25 has been the legal minimum since 2009. Democrats as well as Republicans have not seen fit to do what a right-wing conservative government had to do in Britain. There is no excuse. I turn next to Elon Musk's SpaceX. You know, Elon Musk's SpaceX was recently charged with firing workers who have been trying to organize a union there. Under the law in the United States, and this has been reaffirmed by the National Labor Relations Board and courts many times, it is against the law to punish any worker for his or her legal right to organize a labor union. So now they have a new tack. Not just Elon Musk's SpaceX, but they've been joined in this tack by Trader Joe's, Starbucks, and Amazon. They're going to the Supreme Court. Of course they are, with a right-wing Supreme Court of the kind we have. And they're questioning the right of the government to regulate their abilities and relations with the workers. They want to be able to fire on whim, whether the workers organizing a union or not. They don't want to be held back. They don't want to be regulated. They don't want to be regulated anywhere. And they've been fighting it one way or another, ignoring the regulation, evading the regulations. That's why they got charged with firing people legally organizing a union. So now the effort is to get the Supreme Court, right-wing as it is, to take away the right to regulate from the National Labor Relations Board so it can't enforce the kinds of laws they don't like. You know, the interesting thing is the class struggle never stops. The employer never stops trying to figure out how to give less to the employee. And don't be fooled when the employer says, this has something to do with freedom. We have to have the freedom. It's not incorrect what they're saying. They want the freedom to fire a worker who's trying to organize a union. They want that freedom. But you know, the workers want the freedom to organize a union, to improve the wages and working conditions they have, to be able to give more to their children, their spouses, their parents. They want the freedom to have a secure job as long as they're doing the work. They want a freedom that contradicts the freedom that the employer wants. So it's not a question of freedom. It's a question of freedom for whom? For the employers, 1-3% of the population, or the employees, the overwhelming majority. If you care about freedom, you got to face that it's always a question of freedom for whom. We turn next to another update. China is now producing the highest quality and the cheapest price of electric vehicles, the kind of vehicles that more and more people around the world, including the United States, are thinking of buying because of their less damaging impact on the environment and so on. The problem at first was for the Chinese to service their own market, which they now do. Then they began to export these vehicles to Europe, where they're getting snapped up right now because they are better than most alternatives and they are cheaper than most alternatives. But they're not in the United States. Why? Answer, simple. There's a 27.5% tariff. In other words, they can't sell their car, the Chinese, particularly the BYD Corporation, the leading producer of electric vehicles in China. They can't sell their cars in the United States for the cheaper price that would lead many Americans to buy them, because they have to add to the price the tax that an importer here in the United States has to pay. A tariff on a car from China is payable by the American car dealers that bring those cars in, and they will therefore charge you and me the price of the car. That's very attractive. Plus 27.5% makes it much less attractive. That's why we don't already have those cars. But make no mistake and be clear on what that means. It means you as a consumer are denied the ability to buy the better, cheaper Chinese car. You're simply denied doing it. And not just you as a consumer, but the businesses that buy electric trucks or that buy electric cars in fleets for their work, taxi companies, shipping companies, everybody who needs a car or a truck or both. Those businesses can't buy the cheaper Chinese better cars and trucks. They have to buy American cars and trucks, which have a higher price, but don't have to pay the tariff, which means they charge more for whatever they sell, a taxi ride, a delivered banana, whatever it is, than they otherwise would. Our inflation is partly determined by the tariffs imposed on the Chinese for a whole range of goods, including the automobile. And don't be fooled by notions, ooh, we can't have that electric truck because it has links to the Chinese government. All car companies have links to the military for whom they provide vehicles. That's true in every major country that produces automobiles. We are no different. This is about competition, or to be more accurate, about the inability of the United States and of Western Europe to compete effectively with the Chinese. So if you can't compete, you protect your own, and that raises the price for everybody, and that's the price we're paying. Last updates today, and I want to thank Charlie Fabian for having done the work to do it. After years, 3 to 4 years, of really courageous organizing by the workers in every Starbucks in this country, hundreds have been organized into unions, but up until now, the Starbucks company refused to negotiate with them, refused to work out a contract, threatened them with closing the business, and so on. But they didn't cave in, the union. They kept fighting. They kept pushing. And now they won. Starbucks Corporation announced it will now sit down with these unions to work out contracts to cover them. I guess Starbucks is afraid that it wasn't able to stop the union effort by stonewalling. Maybe cooperation will at least slow the process. Another victory for workers at Starbucks. And finally, a shout-out to the legislature in Michigan, the state of Michigan. They just repealed the state's 58-year-old right-to-work law. Let me explain. That comes out of Taft-Hartley in 1947. It's a law that says whatever a union wins at a workplace, the benefits, higher wages, better conditions, have to be given to every worker there, whether or not he or she joins a union. And the right-to-work law says they don't have to join the union. So they get all the benefits, and they don't have to join. And the unions have seen that for what it was, an assault on the unions. You get the benefit, pay. You don't pay, you don't get the benefit. Now, for the first time in Michigan in 58 years, no more right-to-work. You get the benefits, you need to join the union. Progress, more labor militancy, worth noting. We've come to the end of the first half of today's show. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Bernie Sanders speechwriter Richard R.J. Eskow. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. I'm very glad to bring to our microphone and our cameras an old friend, Richard R.J. Eskow. He's a journalist and host of The Zero Hour, a syndicated radio and television program that I've been on, a lead writer, speechwriter, and editor for Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. He has also been a featured columnist at the Huffington Post. He worked for years in the corporate world, with governments and with multinational organizations such as the World Bank, specializing in healthcare financing, policy, and information technology. So first of all, Richard, from one Richard to another, welcome and thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure being here.
I want to take advantage of all the years you've spent studying, looking at, participating in American politics and even more broadly globally, and ask you a question that's coming at me a lot more often than it ever did. And here's how I would put it. Are we in another phase or period of American history, or is there something basically wrong that is coming to the surface and agitating this society in new and different ways? How do you feel about that either-or situation?
Well, I'm glad you phrased it by saying, how do you feel? Because in the end, I mean, it's a matter you can analyze the information. And of course, you do, I do, many of us do. But when you do that, you speak primarily in terms of probabilities and possibilities. In terms of intuition, feeling, sense, on top of that, the best guidepost that I can refer to, and I refer to it often in my own thinking about what's going on now, is the time I spent in what was the Soviet sphere of Europe before, during, and after the fall of the Soviet Union. And that was a transformative change that many people thought would never happen, pretty much up until the time it did happen. Once it began, people have forgotten now, but there's a lot of talk about expectations that it would be more moderate and dramatic, the shift, than it turned out to be. And we could explore at length some of this visible and less visible causes of that transformation. But on a level, whatever level that a person takes after having lived a long time and being in many different situations, it feels somehow similar now in terms of the West, the American Empire, if you want to use that term, which I do sometimes, the global financial system. And if you add on top of that, the analytical piece, which is, of course, critical. You can't go on into either alone. Can't speak with certainty, but it certainly feels and appears as if something fundamental not only could shift, but may already be in the process of shifting.
Okay, here's another way to get at the question. We are, and the whole world is watching us in some sense, we are heading into the craziest period of a presidential election. And what we have are presumably the best and the brightest of the people we could possibly choose among the 330 million citizens of this country. And here we are with Trump and Biden and massive amounts of information, including polling, indicating huge portions of the American people would rather almost anybody other than either or both of these two. What does that tell us about this society that you have that level of disconnect? And, I could go on, the numbers too. The Supreme Court is approved by less than a fifth of our people. The Congress is not approved. It is a level of distaste, verging on disgust, that large numbers of our people have, some with one candidate, some with the other, and a great many with both of them.
Well, I think that, I'm tempted to quote the musician Frank Zappa, who said that politics is the entertainment division of the military-industrial complex. But, that's part of it, I think. But I think another part of it is the sclerotic nature of our politics. You see it framed in liberal terms in the media and certainly among a lot of Democrats as democracy will be on the ballot in 2024, or we're facing an existential threat to our democracy. I don't deny the fascistic tendencies or totalitarian rhetoric of someone like Donald Trump, but we haven't had a functioning democracy for quite some time. It's naivete. Nobody in the rest of the world, I've spent a lot of time working outside this country too, as of you, and I don't think anywhere in the world is it believed that either the country where people live or this country, in most cases, has anything resembling a functioning democracy. It has limited democratic characteristics. You're allowed to pick from one of two options, a very limited menu of policy choices, but that's about it. And in essence, it's more of a stylistic choice than anything else, and some noodling around the margins. You know, I mean, you'll pay a little bit less for your medications on Medicare if it's under certain conditions, if Biden is reelected or whatever. But the fact is, you'll also see, if anything, more military aggression around the world based on experience. Biden has essentially taken Trump's military policy, especially in the Middle East, to double down on it. We have an odd situation where the dysfunctionality of the political system that was simmering for so many years has exploded into the open. And if anything, I think it's an encouraging sign that people are beginning to see in this election a reflection of what's been under the surface for so long. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And I like the phrase, I know it's very popular, but I like the phrase that says something like this, that we have been a society that has kicked fundamental problems like so many cans down the road. And we have now done that long enough that having arrived at the far end of the road, we are overwhelmed by all the cans that are still there, whether it's our racial divisions, whether it's our primitive notions of what political discourse ought to be, our view of the world in black and white terms of extremes without any notion of the middle, the religiousification, if I can say it, of disagreement. So it all becomes fundamental questions of existence. It's remarkable. And I think it puts us in a very, very dangerous place. I want to shift gears now because I know my audience will be interested. You were intimately involved at the highest levels of Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016, writing speeches, editing, just at the core. And I know you have thoughts that I want to share with our audience. What do you think Bernie achieved? What was the importance in the longer historical flow of events? How are we to understand the Sanders campaign in 2016, and if you want to extend it in 2020 as well?
Well, I think one way to look at it is if American politics is theatrical, he broke the proscenium, as they say in the theater. You know, he spoke directly to the audience rather than to the other characters on the stage. And that was always a powerful quality of his, one that Donald Trump saw the power in and imitated. And I saw Trump imitating Bernie's rhetoric and his style in real time, but it was sincere with Bernie. In other words, I don't have to play this game was one element of Bernie's appeal. I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to use false high-flown rhetoric to express the ideas, what's really on people, working people's minds, what they're really suffering from. So I think that stylistic break made him enormously popular to a lot of people. I think he also named the elephant in the room, which is the billionaire class and the corporate class that is in fact running things. And the horror expressed by mainstream politicians that he should say such a rude thing, to me only reflects the accuracy of it, that we have politics dominated by the oligarchical class and funded by it. So I think that woke people up. I think he also demystified the concept of socialism. I think that everybody assumed that someone who identified himself as a democratic socialist, we could argue whether he is or isn't in fact, but he does use the term. In retrospect, he seems more like a Scandinavian social democrat, but you know, that's big progress for the United States. And I think that opened up a lot of people, especially young people, to thinking in different ways. They were already moving in that direction through Occupy movement and other things. So it reinforced the idea that you don't have to think about the economy and the way we govern ourselves collectively as a society along the very constrained capitalist-driven ways we have been. And I think that was a huge achievement going forward. There, you know, there have been slides back, and you know, the Democratic Party has fought what he represents at every turn. We could talk about his tactics here and there, but the fact is that was an enormous breakthrough in politics, I think. It's up to us now to take advantage of it.
Well, that leads me, your comment on Bernie's championing the very word and the openness about socialism. You're a socialist too. And I wonder, given your long activities both in the Democratic Party and in American politics and in the corporate world, both here and abroad, is it fair to say that all of that has left you a socialist? In other words, the wisdom you've drawn from your life looking at this system is that we can do better and we ought to, and socialism is the direction you want to see us go?
I do. And my generation of Americans was trained to be terrified of the word or the concept, but the fact is I worked a lot on healthcare financing projects around the world, including in the emerging communist countries. I worked a lot on multinational groups where I was brought in by the State Department on World Bank mission to represent, quote unquote, the private sector perspective on healthcare financing. And it quickly became obvious how absurd it was. And working in the in healthcare financing here, equally absurd, the enormous superstructures we've had to build to accommodate the literally lethal intrusion of finance, of for-profit finance into healthcare is insane. So yeah, it's a matter of observation. It's a process of elimination. It's common sense. It's reconnecting with, you know, the values I had starting out. It's a sense of, in the egalitarianism, comradeship, all the best senses of the word. Yeah, I would say those experiences me from point A to point B.
Richard, as always, at the end of these interviews, I can't believe how quickly the time went by. You are an eloquent spokesperson for a perspective that is growing in the United States. And I can assure you that my audience, which is part of that movement, will appreciate as I do and learn from as I do what you have to say. Every good wish to you. Thank you very much for your time. And to my audience, I say, as I always do, that I look forward to speaking with you again next week.